This year, one of our union's goals was to promote wellness in the workplace, improve staff morale. And to that end, we struck a union wellness committee. And our chair is here this evening, Alex Younger, and several members of the committee are here tonight. And the committee has been working very hard in getting a program together for staff that will help, will empower staff to make themselves in the workplace better places. So tonight I'm very pleased tonight that we have two speakers, Dr. Baker and Dr. Ross. And I'm going to turn proceedings over to Alex. And I'd like to thank everybody, members of LMT. We have some other guests and our union members for coming this evening. Thank you very much for coming.
Tonight starts with a great support. Thank you to 391, everyone that's involved, all of us all tonight. Thank you for your help, John. That's great. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ray Baker. He's a physician of both family and addictions medicine, and Ray, as an assistant professor, was the first person to introduce curriculum on addictions medicine at UBC. And he's the primary author of the British Columbia Standards on addictions medicine. And also this spring, Ray was at a conference, this occupational health and safety conference, discussing invisible disabilities, which could be anything I gather from various addictions to work, sex, or other more obvious disabilities. And tonight, though, Ray is going to discuss stress reduction and risk factors and ways that we can prevent this. I'll let Ray take over. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alex. Oh, I always like having people applaud before I get started. From here on, it may be all downhill, you never know. So what does a guy who works in the field of addiction medicine know about stress and burnout? Well, I'll tell you. For me, this information is I'm passionate about it. Because for me, it's personally a matter of life and death that I incorporate some of this stuff in my life. In November 1984, I'd been in practice for 10 years from medical school. And I was in a small town delivering babies, working in the emergency department, had two little kids of my own at home, and I just worked. And I worked harder and harder. And the reason I knew I was a good guy and I was valuable is because I achieved so much. And I did, right up until I couldn't anymore. So in that November afternoon, running 2 hours behind with a waiting room full of patients, I let myself out the back door of my office and I walked away. And so what I'm going to share with you tonight is a combination of science and evidence with a lot of personal experience. Okay? And to be fair, my diagnosis wasn't simply burnout, as is often the case. If had anyone asked the right questions, they would have also made a diagnosis of a substance use disorder. And as a typical substance-dependent person, I was an overachiever rather than an underachiever. Okay? And I really am a fairly typical addicted person in that I usually come first when I do stuff, unless it kills me. So, and that's fairly typical in the workplace. So very often, one of the reasons I got really interested in presenting this is addictions are the great imposters. They can mimic anything from depression to chronic pain to stress. And when I get a letter written by a doctor saying, this employee can't work because of stress and I recommend stress leave, I groan because stress like that is not a diagnosis and stress leave never much of anything. There probably is an issue that needs to be fixed, and I don't know what it is yet. It could be addiction, it could be a whole bunch of other things. So, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of different areas. How many people here have gone to a talk on stress and burnout before? Okay, so most of and so you're going to expect me to talk about ways to reduce stress reduction. I'm not going to talk very much about ways to reduce stress. Okay, I'm going to talk about something much more fundamental. I'm going to talk about the stuff that's underneath the water, the underlying factors. So we're going to talk about what is burnout, technically. What's this addiction called the compulsive overwork? And do library workers ever get it? And some of the family systems and the workplace systems that really either predispose us to this problem or give us resilience and protect us from it. And then the last part of the talk, you know, if you smell smoke, if you're burning out, what to do about it, what recovery is all about. And I'll share, and I've got a whole bunch of bibliotherapy for you if you're interested in learning more. Okay. So burnout is, here are some of the symptoms, okay, and this is from the Annals of Internal Medicine. The person is tired, they become negative, cynical, they lose their ability to effectively do their job, they depersonalize, even when they're with people, they become isolated. They have psychosomatic type of symptoms, relationships start to fail, they're tired all the time, they get organ system problems like peptic ulcer disease, high blood pressure, they might even have a heart attack. And frequently they have mood disorder. They may contribute to substance use disorders. We're not sure that. They go together, but we don't know which comes first, which contributes. Now, not everybody burns out. I just addressed the Canadian Bar Association national meeting here at the Canada Place. And they had me talk about this topic, lawyers crash and burnout. And they had me back to back with one of the most famous trial lawyers here who is talking about avoiding burnout. It's Richard Peck, who defended the Air India bombers. And he's really a famous defense lawyer. And I was giving basically this talk, and he was saying things like, listen carefully, he was saying, you have to know your thermostat. You have to know how much you can take in the way of stress. You know, some of you young lawyers can work 80, 90 hours a week. Some of you 70. Some of you might only be able to work 60 hours. Did you know that? Bizarre. Anyway, that the workplace law is probably one area that's worse than medicine for workplace stress. So, and there are stressors within the workplace that can be altered. And we'll talk about those. Let's first of all talk about the people who don't burn out. In medicine, it's pediatricians for some reason. I don't know why. Pediatricians are less likely to burn out. Radiologists don't burn out often either. Okay? It's people who are comfortable living in their skin. They may be aware of their warts, but they're okay with them. This is a very important one. People who have long-term nurturing relationships with other people are less likely to demonstrate burnout. People who have a sense of they have a power to influence their own destiny, they have a sense of some control. And as we get into the slides on workplace problems, we'll see that workplaces where you lose autonomy are hazardous for your health. They feel that they've mastered their particular area. I found a huge difference being a small town GP where you're jack of all trades, master of none. You're always having to be okay with not knowing really what you're doing. You're faking it. Coming to a small area that I can feel mastery over, and it's just so much easier, less stressful. A sense of purpose, a spiritual direction, a reason for being here seems to be important. And a person who's involved in growing. You know the old saying, if you're not swimming upstream, you're probably going downstream. People involved in some kind of personal growth are more resilient for some reason. Okay. Now, the opposite end of the spectrum, I'm going to make some of you nervous with this slide. On Saturday, I was up at the Class of 95 reunion. They were my favorite medical class I ever taught. They were known as the Class That Cared. They were wonderful. This is their 10-year reunion, and at 10 years, doctors are, remember I told you, when I crashed and burned? That's about when doctors start to crash and burn. And so when I presented this slide to the Muffled Whistler, they asked me to do a talk on burnout, and people were really starting to either laugh nervously or get embarrassed over this, because that's what gets us into medical school, by being driven by compulsiveness. Usually a bit irrational, so we're driven by doubt and guilt, and we carry around this exaggerated sense a responsibility, more than we really have. I've had a patient in my office say that they felt that they were responsible for the Second World War, you know, that sort of that cognitive distortion that we feel overly responsible. Notice this? What's the other word for this? Person who has trouble setting limits has problems with
boundaries.
Bingo. People, boundaries are going to come back again and again and again. Boundaries and burnout. Those who are really good at looking after other people but leave themselves to the last, they do really well for a while until they don't. Okay. Putting off attending to unimportant things like family relationships until the work is all done. Okay. Did it. So these are, and this really describes probably 35% of health professionals. Okay, something sets us up. We reach a point, you've heard the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's usually associated with one or several very discrete situations or incidents, whereas this is different. This is prolonged, unrelieved stress with no break. It results in very similar neurobiological changes in the brain. Workload that grows, but I have no control over it. This is poison. People who feel that they're being treated unfairly and they have no power over that unfairness, if they can't get out, or if they feel they can't get out of that situation, they get sick. And I'm going to show you two slides to show you how they get sick. What's it called? Does anybody know the term? And you're not allowed to answer. Does anybody know the term when your values are here, my right and wrong is here, yet I'm functioning and my behavior's down here? What's that called? It's called cognitive dissonance. What's it feel like when my behavior doesn't match my values? What's it feel like? Feels bad, but give me a word. What kind of feeling would it be? How about guilt or anxiety, where I'm forced to do stuff that isn't quite right? Okay, somebody asked me if I'd be presenting this. This is from Wilkerson's round table. They documented the 10 commonest causes of workplace stress in Canada. And they overlap a bit, but they're about lack of autonomy, lack of communication, lack of appreciation. The rules keep changing. Don't know what my job description is. Policies change. There is unhealthy interpersonal dynamics that don't get fixed. Usually meaning there's weak leadership, so the gossip gets going and it harms everyone. Interruptions on a randomized basis, too much to do, too little time. I don't think there's any surprises there. I think this is a more common scenario than it used to be for two or three societal reasons. What are those reasons? Why are we more likely to see this now than perhaps 15 years ago? Companies have focused an awful lot more on the bottom line, so we see downsizing, downsizing, downsizing. Does anybody old enough to remember when you could just on a whim go over on an evening or a Sunday and visit people unannounced and go for coffee? Do you remember that? Or sit in the porch and just do nothing? You don't do it anymore because everybody's busy. Everybody's working, as the author of Dr. Svensson says, everybody works to the margins are no longer there. We work right to the edges. We bring our cell phone and our Palm Pilot home and we go. We thought in the 50s, with technological advances, what did we think? We thought we'd be sitting around doing nothing because all this technology. What we didn't factor in was our greed. We decided we wanted more. Both of us were, you know, so. Okay, so there have been some real incredible societal changes that increase our levels of stress. The next several slides are on work addiction. I've got something for you here. There's enough for more than one each. It's called the WART. You ever heard of the WART? Work Addiction Risk Test? Okay, there's two groups that always fail this. It's union executives and medical residents and physicians. But it's a validated test for work addiction. Work addiction is a kind of a unique addiction because all I do is assessments. And when I do an assessment, I assess people for medical problems and psychiatric problems and social problems, and then for addictions. And I go through the addictions. Do you believe that there's some good addictions and bad addictions? In other words, do we put different levels of stigma on various addictions? Like if I ask you, are you a sex addict? There's stigma there. Okay? Or a heroin or a crack cocaine addict? There's stigma. Maybe prescription drugs is a little higher. You know, nicotine for some reason isn't put down there with other drugs that are as likely to kill you. But then I get to workaholism. What do people do? They kind of puff out the chest and say, yeah, I guess so. You know, we still, when I get announced as a speaker, often to build me up to my audience, they list all the compulsive, ridiculous things I've done, you know, while I was supposed to be raising kids. Well, let me tell you something that's embarrassing. I used to treat a lot of doctors. And I treat a lot of other addicted family systems. The kids of an addicted workaholic physician or a workaholic anything look very similar to the kids of an alcoholic parent. The same dynamics are there. They're just as messed up and damaged. So it's not such a pretty addiction. The idea of an addiction is that it's a syndrome that we do to make ourselves feel better despite it causing harm. So it's a behavioral syndrome with loss of control, can't control my work habits, and it hurts other parts of my life. If I had work addiction, I'm going to feel time pressure. I use my time pressure as a way to distract myself and as a way to get myself to get the job done. So there's always tension, tension, tension. Gotta go. I set deadlines for myself even though I don't have to. I need to be in control because it's got to be perfect and other people won't get it right. So I'm not very good at delegating. I set high standards for myself and I set high standards for everybody around me. And eventually, relationships, the people around me get sick of it because my work comes first. And my emotional status, because of my workaholism, makes it difficult to be around me. I go on these binge patterns, I set deadlines, and then I work in a binge pattern. Great way to escape the here and now, the feelings. It used to be when I would go to Hawaii, Agnes and the kids knew to stay away from me for the first 2 days because I could be in withdrawal. I'd be really irritable and grumpy for the first 2 days until I came down. DWW, thriving while working. When you're heading down the White Rock on the way home, you don't remember going through the tunnel. Or, as someone said at a meeting, is that on Friday night, he's mastered the knot. Even when he's home, he's not home because he's working on stuff, you know. I used to be able to find that I could put a Mickey in behind the spare tire compartment in the car. You know what else fits in there? You can put in a laptop and a couple of patient files in the same spot. Same thing. Here's a real dilemma. Because of all that time pressure, gotta get it done. Remember, I'm a relentless perfectionist. And so I go off half-cocked, and what do I feel when I mess it up? What's the feeling I get?
Cringe.
Somebody said shame. Absolutely. Overwhelmed with shame. No damn good. Okay. Human doing, I'm only as good as my last achievement. Physicians are notorious for that. What's the problem with being a human doing, as John Bradshaw was saying? What's the problem with that?
Because you're not being.
You're not being, so you're not in the here and now. But there's a more pragmatic, practical problem with that. All of my sense of being worthy comes from without. So, as a doctor, I'm screwed because they're all going to die. You know, so it has to be an inside job, feeling okay. As long as I'm blaming or expecting other people to fix me, it ain't going to work. Never enough time to do the look after myself, because they don't see it as valuable. Okay, what does it feel like? Well, the interesting thing is the workaholic has alexithymia. Anybody familiar with that? A is without, no, it's not Alice, it's A. A is without, lex is read, thymia is feelings, can't read my feelings. And we'll talk about where that came from in people who are prone to develop this kind of problem. So I may have all these feelings, but I wouldn't know it. So I'm not really aware of what I'm numbing out with my addictive behavior, whether it's my work or my alcohol or my marijuana is great for it. Okay, so one of the things in recovery is trying to get a handle, thaw out enough to figure out what some of those feelings are. Okay, let's go back to the beginning early in our life. It's been determined that the commonest relationship styles in the families are the democratic one, where everybody's got an equal vote, including the two-year-old omnipotent child. The problem with that is it's not appropriate, okay? Or the permissive family, where no is never heard. There's no discipline, there are no rules. What's the message a child in a permissive home without rules gets? What's the message you carry as a child? Don't care. You don't care. So there aren't fights, but nobody cares. Okay? And then there's the authoritarian, where the child isn't heard, you do it because, just because, it's the way you do it. And there's usually some anger behind that. And then somewhere in the middle is this authoritative, where there's a mixture of democracy but appropriate delegation of responsibility. And what they found is the kids from this family system are healthier psychologically, and they have better attachment. So, in the authoritative system, and this is something to take to the workplace too, power is held in trust to be exercised in the best interest of those subject to it. Authoritative family relationships give way to mutual relationship as adulthood approaches. And my two kids are now in their 20s, and it's starting to happen at times. But they still come back for money, but. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. If you have never done this, it can be a very upsetting genealogy. I just want to talk about a couple of points. First of all, the alcoholic family system was widely, widely studied, and it's been validated. And the roles that come out of that family system are widely validated. And if you wanted to learn more on the second last slide, Janet Wojcik's ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, there's a huge literature on it. I supervised a PhD candidate at UBC School of Psychology on this very topic. It's just really well validated. The problem, and this family system, two caveats. One is some kids can come through a very dysfunctional alcoholic family system and come through unscathed, relatively unscathed, and be normal. So not everybody from this family system is screwed up. And the other thing is, even healthy family systems have the same dynamics. So if you see these dynamics, well, don't feel bad if it's not a problem, if it's not causing problems. Okay? But it can cause problems because the dynamics set up, the system that resists change, that's set up to survive when one family of the member has an addictive disorder, the system works and it's designed for survival. The roles that these children discover are brilliant survival techniques for kids in an unsafe home where they don't get their basic needs met, like love, nurturance, constancy. And so these are healthy kids. However, if they grow up in the system, they grow up with some absent coping skills, which really sets them up for certain disorders. One of them is burnout. Another is addictions. Another is chronic pain syndromes. And I'll just talk a little bit about it. So Adam's drug of choice could be a combination of work, alcohol, and sex, or crack cocaine, or work and gambling. Doesn't really matter. Cheryl's drug of choice is Adam. Okay? She knows that if she was a more complete human being, she could fix him. She couldn't fix her dad, who was the alcoholic, but maybe she'll be able to fix Adam. And of course, she can, but she takes more and more responsibility until she gets sicker and sicker. The favorite role in this family system is the oldest child. If the child can hold on to this role, they will, and that's the hero. That's the child who early on figures out the dynamics, can sense when dad's mad or has been drinking, knows how to do the conflict resolution, to anticipate problems, to take responsibility for parenting her siblings, getting mom out of bed because she took her Valiums too early, before dad gets home and has an explosion. When Harriet goes off to school, Harriet is popular with the other kids for certain things because she's good at conflict resolution. She's very mature for her age. She's deprived of her childhood. She gets what kind of marks? Straight A's. Okay. She, even though she's got flat feet, she comes second in track and field just out of grim determination. President of the Students' Council. She goes into nursing and medicine and police work and teaching. I don't want to leave anybody out here. There's a joke that says that adult children from alcoholic families are attracted to healthcare like lemmings to the sea. Now, the second kid comes along, Stevie comes along, the family's crazy, you know, you're not allowed to talk about what's really going on, and you lie about what's really going on, because you're not allowed to talk about the elephant in the living room. You never bring kids home, because it's now embarrassing, because they get shamed by dad, and the rules keep changing. You're not allowed to say how scared and angry and ashamed you are, because you're told you don't have those feelings, and they're not tolerated. So quickly, you learn how to just sort of not feel them, just to sort of shut them down. So Stevie comes along, detects that the family is in chaos, knows that he's to blame for it. Every kid feels that they're responsible, so he tries to fix it, like Harriet successfully did. But everything he tries to do to be the best at, old goody-goody-two-shoes has a two-year head start. And she, even when he is good at something, she sabotages him. However, he does discover soon that he's got an important role to play. What is it? Be the blame. So, because you're not allowed to talk about what's wrong in the family, he can be the one to the lightning rod to take the blame. I see him all the time in my office. They bring him in, he's 13 years old, he's wearing black, he's been playing hooky, they found drugs in his room, and they say, you fix this little son of a gun and we'll be okay. No, we won't. Okay. Lisa, tonight I thought about Lisa. Lisa, Adam comes home, it's payday, he's late. He gets everybody up to give him a family lecture. He pushes mom. Harriet gets between them and tries to do some conflict resolution. Stevie does a finger, uses the F word, slams the door on his way up. Lisa takes her teddy bear and her Sony Walkman and disappears into her room, goes in the closet under her bed. Lisa goes through life being invisible. When Lisa gets seized, by the way. She's the brightest of the bunch, but her job in life is to be invisible. Do you think Lisa would be attracted to the library? I don't know. And then there's Mikey, the class clown. Okay, the really important things to remember from this, and I use this a lot when we're teaching doctors on the treatment of chronic pain syndromes, because if you're not allowed to have those negative emotions, they often express themselves somatically, because you are allowed to get sick. Evidence shows that kids from this family, everybody from this family system goes to the doctor twice as frequently as their age-matched comparison group. And because all of that awful emotional stuff can't get expressed, you are allowed to get sick. So the asthma, the headaches, the chronic pain syndromes eventually. Okay? So by the time I see Harriet, she's 36, she's failed her third marriage, she's been involved in her second rear-end collision and it just won't go away, and she's now been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. She had an eating disorder for a while, and she was voted most likely to succeed. She was the most valuable employee all the way through until she started falling apart and she could no longer carry it all on her shoulders. Okay. Harriet has no boundaries. Can Harriet recover? Yeah, you sure can. Everything we're talking about is quite fixable. So if you came from this family system why is control so important to the kids in that family system? Why is it important that they control everybody's life around them? They never experienced anything. Life was unsafe, and if they were the hero, it was their job to keep it safe at home, even though the rules kept changing. I don't know how many times I've heard people say, he was out there, he was pushing, I knew she was going to get hurt, so I left my bedroom, and went out. I knew he was going to kill me, but it was my job. I had to take the flak. So control, when people are real controllers and have trouble allowing others to help, often it's from that childhood need to keep it safe. Trust, the rules kept changing. How am I going to trust? You say develop a relationship with a higher power? I don't think so. You're kidding me. I mean, and last time I did that, I got nearly killed. Don't have feelings. You know, I can remember coming home from the emergency department after a 12-hour shift where I'd seen 88 patients, three of them died, declared an 8-year-old child, pronounced him dead, driving home, seeing double, I was so tired. I walked in the door, and Agnes said, how was your day? What did I say? Fine. I was a little busy, okay? But I did notice that when I poured a scotch, that knot disappeared. And I thought, I should publish. I've got a fibromuscular gastroesophageal band that responds to the drug ethanol. And so what was that knot? It was fear. It was just raw fear. I was terrified. I had no idea what fear was because I was raised not to have fear. I may be totally dependent on the others, or I may not let them close. It could be totally independent, rationally so, or the reverse. The biggest one of these ungrieved losses, I'm not going to grieve many of them, but the biggest one is my childhood that I didn't have because I was busy looking after other people. Terrified of abandonment, perhaps. I may tolerate the intolerable in a relationship because of that crazy fear that I'm going to be abandoned forever. All or nothing thinking, either I'm the best or I'm no damn good. Either it's perfect. It's adolescent thinking, really, but very common in adults from alcoholic family systems. I may put up with inappropriate behavior because I grew up, even though on the outside we look good, our family looked good in the community, everybody thought we were a normal family. I don't know what normal is. And so crazy stuff would go on and we'd just carry on and not even notice it. So when I get into my next family system, I'm not going to notice it. And I will tolerate the intolerable. I take too much responsibility because I was trained to. What happens to the person that you're taking too much responsibility for? What happens to them when you do that? Absolutely. You harm them. You're giving them the message that you're incompetent. And especially for people with addictions or chronic pain, victims never recover. Okay? As long as they're blaming somebody else or in denial, they're never going to recover. So if you deprive them of the pain of their behavior, you're harming them. You're killing them with kindness. Very commonly, we neglect our own needs. It's even shameful to take the time to look after our own. Have trouble with conflict. Agnes and I, by 1984, had been married for 14 years, and we'd never had a fight. Why had we never had a fight? We came from that kind of a family system, and when fights happened, terrible things. Nobody showed us how to fight, so we didn't. What happens in a relationship if you never fight? Marriage. Eventually, it's done, because you've got all these grievances, files of grievances that are unresolved. Didn't know how to do conflict resolution. All of this stuff is fixable. Don't know how to do intimacy. If I've got lousy boundaries, I either get enmeshed with people or I have to keep them too far away. What on earth do I do intimacy? Don't know how. It's learnable. Okay, let's talk a little bit about fairness. Lack of fairness, growing up in an inherently unfair situation, interferes with attachment, which is necessary for emotional regulation. At least that's theoretical. It certainly interferes with something in the workplace as well. Now, for those, physicians don't have to be convinced of this. Patients often does because they say, doctor, are you saying it's all in my head? Like when I talk to a patient who's got fibromyalgia, whose parent was an abusive alcoholic. Are you saying it's all in my head? Well, sorry, it doesn't come like that. there isn't a medical model versus a psychosocial model. They come together. The basis for cognitive therapy, Burns, Feeling Good, New Mood Therapy, when this was originally theoretical, they thought, you know, maybe we feel bad because, first of all, we have the negative thought. And they proved it. It's no longer just a theory. That's why, with mild to moderate depression, cognitive therapy works at least as well as SSRIs, antidepressant medications. But it doesn't stop there. My emotions affect my limbic system and hypothalamus, which affects my heart, my blood pressure, my immune system, which protects me from infection and cancer, my peptic ulcer disease, my asthma, all of my endocrine hormones, musculoskeletal and chronic pain. So it's all hooked in to there. And this is really, really important when it comes down to treatment. That we have to, you cannot take a biomechanical approach to dealing with these complex individual disabilities. You have to do biopsychosocial treatment. Okay, this is about power and fairness. Okay, so there's power relationships versus mutual relationships. And we won't spend a lot of time on those, but I think unions and management and people in families need to be aware of the different types of approaches. A power-based relationship is the norm. If I'm the employer, I have power that my employee doesn't have. There are certain structures that actually perpetuate that stratification, and it results in two areas of imbalance. Now pay attention to the next three slides, because they've done some science on two types of problems. On the demands put on me and my control over what I do, and the reward I get for my efforts. Okay, here's this first one, that if I have high demand and little control over my output, if other people are demanding that I crank out high, compared to other workplaces, there's been a lot of research that shows these people are more likely to get heart disease, more likely to get mood disorders, more likely to get infections, and more likely to use substances. Isn't that interesting? It's been documented again and again and again. So it makes good dollar and cents sense to address this in the workplace, because it's very, very costly. The cost of disability now in the workplace, did you know that this has now surpassed musculoskeletal injuries? So we're now, this has to be addressed in the workplace. Okay. Effort and reward. This one means I have to put out a lot of effort and I get very low reward. Okay? More likely to have heart attack, stroke, high blood pressure, more likely to have mental health problems. So together, there's more musculoskeletal pain, and look at this. More likely to get cancer. Isn't that interesting? Wow. Okay. So how do we change it? Well, there are certain situations which are inherently power situations, and this idea of consent is absolutely everything. And we're becoming more and more aware of that in the doctor-patient relationship. When I first came out of medical school, it was paternalistic, and a very different model now, recognizing this. Okay? So it's employee-employer is inherently a power relationship that can be altered in a way that makes it feel fair. Okay? Really important point. What's that say? Who said that? Yes, exactly. It's always, everybody says, I am nowhere, and one person in the audience says, no, I am here. And recovery, now the rest of this talk is on recovery, means going from I am nowhere to I am now here. And it working in this field, whether I'm working with chronic pain, burned out, or addicted individuals, you get to see the miracle, where it happens in a moment, where they go from, I am hopeless, I am powerless, the world sucks, to I think I can do it. Okay. If you're identifying with this burnout talk or workaholism talk, and it's been there a while, I really recommend, now I'm biased because this is what I do. It's all I do, but it's The reason I do it is because I've done so many other things, and this is so effective, and it's been neglected. People who are sick enough not to be able to work because of their stress, their burnout, chronic pain, their addictive disorders, are pretty sick puppies. They've got problems that are medical and injury and perhaps brain. They've got psychiatric symptoms, perhaps comorbid diagnoses, and this is the big area that's lacking. It's like a boat with three holes. The issue is that if you don't plug all three holes at the same time, they keep sinking. What's the message that a patient brings in who's been going down with their depression, their stress, their chronic pain, and they've gone to the doctors who've given them all this medication and they're not getting any better? What's the message? It's hopeless. But they've only been here. They haven't. The most valuable part of the thing is here. Okay, so they do need, and the other word picture, as well as a boat with three holes, I want you to think about is a jigsaw puzzle that's missing about five pieces. The people who I see who burn out with stress, chronic pain, addictions, depression, often, because of their family of origin, missed some real key coping strategies. If you were missing a bunch of essential coping strategies, would you know it? No. It's like a colorblind person doesn't know it until they're tested, because for you it's normal. So it's really, really important. Anybody see the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray? Do you remember? There's a great recovery movie because he gets to do his day again and again and again. I mean, the guy's a real jerk at the start of this thing. And do you remember him going down that street? Do you remember the mud puddle that was frozen that he kept stepping in? And going down the street and he'd step in it? You know, but eventually he'd get to the puddle and he stopped and walked around it, and then eventually he went down a different street. In the psychosocial history are patterns of screw-ups, things that we do badly again and again, like always getting attracted to that abusive spouse, trying to fix that one, or screwing up financially, or other lacking coping skills. So consider having an objective third party help you do an inventory to figure out what you got to work on to get well. There's a lot of overlap with various addictive disorders and pain syndromes in these people with invisible disabilities, and they have to be looked for because it'll keep them stuck. Very, very frequently, people who burn out have some addictive behaviors that need to be addressed. What are some of the things that we find in this circle, the psychosocial circle? Well, remember alexithymia? Very frequently people with burnout couldn't. When you ask them, what do you feel about that, what do they tell you? Yeah. No? They don't. What do they say? I don't know. They're not even aware that they don't know. They'll tell you a thought. They'll give you a thought, very clever thought, and they'll keep it cerebral. And so you say, no, that's not a feeling. Give me the feeling. And they'll give you another thought, not realizing they can't name their feelings. Male physicians are notorious for that. You know, they work with people and they can't name a feeling. I can relate. You know, I go into AA meetings. I would listen to people my first 2 years of active, dedicated recovery. And people would talk about their fear and their anger. I had no idea what they were talking about. I thought that I was just lucky. I didn't have those things. And then I realized not only was I terrified of a lot of what I had to do, but I was always angry. And I didn't know it. And so I had to thaw out before I could learn how to deal with those feelings. Nobody showed me how to do intimacy. Nobody showed me how to be a husband or a father. Okay? Learnable? Absolutely. Conflict resolution? How to set priorities? What's important in my life? If I don't know what's important, nowadays I'm doomed. Because I have to make selections. I can't do everything. So I have to be able to prioritize. How many people here have read about boundaries? Excellent. 5 years ago, nobody put up their hand. You know, when I talk to physicians, I say, talk about boundaries, they think I'm talking about sleeping with their patients. But that's true, that's certainly a boundary issue, but if I show me a person who doesn't do boundaries, I'll show you a person who can't do intimacy and is likely to burn out. So don't know how to do fun. If I came from that family system, I may not know, unless I might be the family mascot, I may not know, even have a sense of humor. Don't know how to do balance. Don't know how, it's all work. I'll show you a pie slide that's really helpful for you or if you're working with someone else. Now, these are the cognitive distortions in Burns' book. Cognitive therapy, or one of the variations of cognitive behavioral therapy, is based on the idea that I feel bad because I have negative thinking. The way to look at that, if you're used to computers, the operating systems in this computer is Windows. Okay, it's doing a lot of stuff in the background, but what you're looking at here is a PowerPoint presentation. You don't know what's going on in the background. My operating system could be absolutely screwy. Would I know it? No. So if I had some basic assumptions that I formed in childhood, like the world is a hostile place, or either I am perfect or I'm worthless, okay, a lot of these cognitive distortions. And the trick is to learn them because they can be reprogrammed very easily. Cognitive behavioral therapy is not a time-consuming type of therapy. So people in burnout often are people pleasers. That's why they took on so much, is they couldn't say no. They just kept wanting to please, and they crashed and burned. Pessimistic thinking, the world is a hostile place. Hopeless, I'm a victim, I am powerless. Nonsense, but you have to get over that because victims never recover. No place for humor, though, American-wise. If I get the outside right, I'll be okay in the interior. You know, how many cars does it take? How many expensive suits before? How many pairs of shoes before we realize that it doesn't work? No matter where I go, there I am. Don't shoot on me. I should be available. I should be competent all the time. Okay, that's a setup for guilt. Black and white, all or nothing thinking. Either every evaluation comes in rating me 9 out of 10, or I'm worthless. Magnification, Agnes calls this magnification of the negative, in Al-Anon they call that pole vaulting over mouse turds. Okay, so where you're allowed to laugh at that one. Where we magnify our mistakes and look at our successes as minimal. So when you compliment this person, who's an ultra-serious family hero, when I give you a compliment for your wonderful achievement, you're saying to yourself, well, if you only knew who was really here, who would you be saying that about? Okay. Now, I won't go into this, but if you go to any recovery program for addiction, if it's successful, they incorporate coping skills, accountability to others, personal responsibility, learning about the problem, social support, and spiritual growth. And this is something I found over the years, that people who successfully recover from one of these complex disabilities, whether it's depression or chronic pain syndrome or addictions, they've addressed these. And I've seen people do it in a lot of different ways. One woman came back to me just to gloat after I so forcefully suggested that she go to a treatment center and go to meetings for her addiction. She didn't do any of those. She came back just to say, I didn't do any of those things. That's nice. Thank you for sharing. So I said, what did you do? You know what she did? She had joined Amway. Which I thought, that's just plain stupid. But it isn't, you know. Because a lot of that was built into the program. Just like if you look at an AA or NA or any of the other mutual support programs, all of this is built into us. Okay? So it's just a good checklist for people who find themselves in a hole and want to get out, is to address this checklist. What are some of the coping, remember the first one of these? Some of the coping exercises, learning how to identify those. That very personally for me, until I thawed out. My parents had both been, unexpectedly, they died my first year of practice. You know what I did? I worked harder. I didn't take any time off, I just worked harder. Now, it would be 8 years later that I hit bottom and went out and started my process of recovery. You know what I had to do? I had to grieve my parents, so I had never even wept. And it was very confusing when it happened. I had the thought of, I had to identify those negative distortions. And of the 10 common negative distortions, I led a group of doctors and nurses in recovery called the Caduceus Group. Caduceus is the snake in the, on the staff. And it's for recovering doctors and nurses. And we worked our way through this book, and of those health professionals, just about every one of them had all 10 negative cognitive distortions. So it's very, very common for people who get themselves into emotional trouble to have this as a background. So it's a good investment of your time to look at that. Learn how to manage stress. One of the little things that I did, I used to get the Vancouver Sun every morning. It gets delivered at what, 6 a.m.? So I'd get up early to read the Vancouver Sun. And by the time I left, I was pissed off. I'd drive into work angry, and I just wasted half an hour. Why? So 2 years ago, I stopped getting the Vancouver Sun. I haven't missed a thing, you know? And now I do a spiritual reading, which only takes 10 minutes, and I got to get to sleep in. CBC isn't on anymore. So now, I can put it on one of the comedy channels, and have you ever noticed how you feel when you come home from work and something makes you have a belly laugh? Something very powerful happens there. I used to be on about 18 committees, and now I'm on none. If you asked me now, will I do something, unless your name's Alex, in which case the answer is yes, because I don't know how to say no to Alex, but if you ask me now, and you need an answer right now, the answer is no. If you learn about boundaries, if you haven't done a program on boundaries and you haven't problems with parenting, problems with relationships, learn about boundaries. I've been teaching a group on boundaries for the last 8 years, and every time we go through it, I learn more important stuff about boundaries, because I didn't have an understanding of boundaries other than don't sleep with patients. You can really work a lot of physical exercise into your day. If you work on the 7th floor of this building, you could use the stairs. I actually would say 6 usually, you know, maybe. But do it once a day anyway, because it doesn't take any. It's actually quicker than taking the elevator, and it's really good exercise.
Yeah, that's
true. Learn meditation with doctors. We have to make sure that they see that's a T and not a C. People who are lousy at boundaries always have problems with intimacy. Burnout is just about always a boundary problem. Okay? Show me a person who burns out, and I'll show you a person who's got lousy boundaries. Simple as that. Okay. Anybody remember the Serenity Prayer? What are the things that I can change? Well, my stuff. And this is my stuff. You don't have any right to fiddle with it, to comment about it if I don't ask you. But people with boundary problems typically have either one of two kinds, one of three kinds. One is they've got great holes, so people can walk in and step on them and they don't even realize it's not okay. Or they get boundaries so thick because they've been so hurt that nobody's getting close, nobody's ever going to see in here. I'm so far away from my boundaries. Or they don't recognize other people's boundaries, so they're always stepping on them. Okay? So the typical boundary disturbed people are the doormats, the ones who can't say no, or the controllers. Agnes was one of these, and we've been married now 35 years, and I was one of these. I couldn't hear no, and so I would be more likely to be over-controlling. Did I know it? No. I didn't get any feedback from her, and we didn't even know this game we were playing. Or the people who cannot support others or accept help from others. So if I've got lousy boundaries at work, I'm going to be really resentful because I'm going around doing stuff that wasn't even my responsibility to do. But I'm resentful. Whose problem is that? It's mine. Absolutely, it's mine. It's not theirs. But I'm mad at them. I work overtime because I can't say no. I'm not sure about what's important, so I'm always busy because I've got to get my desk cleared off, even though a third of what's on my desk is garbage. It should be in the garbage can. It shouldn't even take up any of my time. I let other people who are ignorant jerks drive me crazy, you know? And one of my exercises in recovery is to be able to go to rude retail servers and allow them to be rude and not let it, because, you know, they can't, their anger, their rudeness can't jump across and hurt me. So rather than going around feeling bad because they acted like jerks, if I've got good boundaries, I can let them be jerks. It takes a bit of practice at work, but you can get better and better at doing this one. Because when I carry that resentment, it's me that gets killed. Problems with authority so often. Problems with authority are really unresolved parent stuff. Okay? And rather than say anything about it, because we learned we couldn't say it at home, we triangulate. So I'm mad at the boss, so I tell you guys. I tell Sherry about it, and we talk over the cooler about it. And of course, it makes Sherry feel good, because I'm telling her about all the things I'm mad and all the gossip I know about my supervisor. But it's really deadly. Okay? So grumbling, it's just really, really harmful. Expecting my work, remember, being human doing. So if I put everything into my work and I win the highest award, then I'll be somebody and I'll feel good. I'll be done in about 3 minutes. Taking my stuff home. Now, there isn't a clear boundary between work and home. Does anybody have a clear way that they leave their stuff here on their way home? Does anybody have a trick to not bring their workplace stressors home? What are some of the things people do? Yeah. So walking home is a great idea. So you have to get out in the air and you get some exercise, great idea. Any other tricks?
Don't receive email from home. Or email.
So don't let your email get home. That's a really good one. I bet most, if I got a show of hands, I bet people's email from work makes it home. No? Good. Good that you don't. And when I asked the medical students, well, this cute little female doctor said, I sing country and western music at the top of my lungs in the car. Okay, so it's really important to have that break. Just grumbling about work, you know, so many people, all I do is listen to people. And I'm amazed at how many people have spent a whole lifetime doing something they hate to do, as if they don't have a choice. You do. This is a really important, okay? Really, we don't do emergencies. I spend a lot of time with my medical office assistant teaching her that, no, we don't do emergencies. That it may seem like an emergency to the person on the other end of the line because now it's a crisis, but that's their crisis. It's not my crisis. Okay? So, and that's a real important boundary. There are very few real emergencies. Okay. This is terrific. If you do this for yourself, you can figure out, and you can put different headings on your pie of life, but you can draw a pie that's appropriate for you, that's healthy. And with a workaholic or a substance dependent person or chronic pain person, what does this look like? It's only got about two pieces left. Okay? Yeah, it's got work, sleep. That's about it. There's no social. And the other nice thing about it is, when I follow people along doing relapse prevention, long before they have a complete relapse, this starts to go back the way it was. It gets out of whack. For me to be healthy, I gotta have all of those things going. And if I start to neglect, and the ones that I would neglect would be the exercise, and I would neglect the spirituality, and I would start skipping my breakfast, and I start to get really, really unwell. I start to get emotionally the way I was in 1984. Okay, so it's a very valuable tool. Does anybody remember, anybody here read this? The Covey's book? It's got some really good tools in it. One is setting up a business plan, but you have to determine what's important. If I want to be excellent, to do excellent work and to spend my time doing what's important, I have to know what's important. And the trick is, anything that's not important because there's the urgent non-important, which is busy work, and the non-important not-urgent, which you should never, ever even lay eyes on. It should make it to your ground filing cabinet the moment it comes in. And the trick is to get out of those, if you know what's non-important, moving up to the... And if you get proactive enough, you can get into the most important quadrant of all, which is something I spent today on. Today I didn't go to work. I was able to do some personal planning and do some stuff that I really wanted to do, important but not urgent. Okay. Figure out what you believe. Live according to your values. You know, the longer I am a doctor, and the more I talk to older doctors and patients, the more I recognize spirituality as an important part of health. And there's more research to suggest that it is, that spiritual things can be measured to affect human health. So learning prayer and meditation is an important thing. Starting your day off remembering that. Go to some kind of organized, and for many people that might be their AA meeting, but it's some kind of a shared belief system with a group of people, and don't quit before the miracle. Second last slide. These are programs in the workplace that have been shown to be effective. Now this came for health professionals. If, as an employer, we measure values other than just how many gidgets, how many things that are put out, if we measure other values, it can be very helpful in making the workplace more healthy. There should be a health committee. That's what we're doing tonight. Okay? But from a corporate level, decisions should be considered from its impact on personnel health, especially with what we know about fairness. Good argument and point. I testified unsuccessfully, I might add, I testified on behalf of the IWA at a drug testing hearing. And my argument was, you know, random drug testing in the workplace has not been shown to improve health and safety. But it has been shown in Canada that it's perceived to be inherently very unfair. So isn't that interesting? So we've got good evidence that it's hard on health and no evidence that it works. Anyway, I didn't succeed. But we should be making decisions based on employee health. Create a mentor program, very valuable. Support groups now this one comes up if you're dealing in a service industry where you've got secrets. It becomes really important if you're a lawyer, a judge, or a doctor. But support groups are, anybody who's gone through mutual support groups knows how valuable they are for mental health. Go on retreats based only on well-being. One of the perks of working could focus on health, being a member of Just Ladies Fitness or one of those. Scheduling family events and realizing that they're really, really important things. Reduce the amount of needless paperwork we do. When we're designing the workplace environment, we should involve the personnel that are affected. That sounds like a no-brainer. But I'm amazed as a doctor how often those decisions are made for us without any input from the people that have to work in them. On certification exams, we really should put our money where our mouth is and say, I mean, if we really believe employees are valuable and their health is worthwhile, that should be part of our certification exam for whatever level we're working for. Okay. Questions or comments before we sum up? I don't want to use up any more of Adrian's time. Burnout is really a symptom, a set of symptoms of other problems. And it's a combination of childhood experience, lack of coping skills, like boundaries and balance, and stressors, either in the workplace or at home or both. Either our family and workplace can contribute to our health, or they can contribute to the problem. There are good techniques for recovery. Everything we talked about today is fixable. So people who come in with their fibromyalgia, burnout, depression, chronic pain syndrome, or alcoholism can get a life back. Spirituality is a key, important part of the process. This is the bibliotherapy. If you want to go any further, all these books are up here. They've all got some really important things in them, like your money or your life. You know, if you take a group of people, if we took you all and set you around tables and said, here's your question, how much money is enough? What do you think the answer would be? Just a little bit more. Because we don't know. We think that we'd be a little happier if we had a little bit more, which is nonsense. One of the things that they studied in this book was they drew the line between stuff, amount of resources, and happiness. And sure enough, down at the bottom end, when you don't have enough, it's important. But you reach a point where the line levels off, and when you increase your amount of stuff and money, you know what happens? Quality of life actually falls off. So the trick is to find out where that is for you and figure out how to keep your net up and your gross down. An awful lot of what we spend, we waste. Oh, and there's lots of good resources here. Thank you. I'll leave the work test, the work addiction risk test, up here so you can grab them at the end.